Doesn't. I'll kill him. I'd have killed him myself if it would have solved anything. Mal, I called. Mal! But he was already gone. Vanished, like a shadow into the storm-bound night. What he left behind was a hollow space in my chest that began to fill with a hot, heavy anger. I would be the master of my own fate, me and the goddess Morrigan. No one else, and certainly no man. Mal and Aiden could fight over me until they were both bloody. My father could deny me my blade, but they couldn't force me from my warrior's path unless I let them. Sorsha never would have let anyone choose her fate for her. Go then, I said, my voice loud in the emptiness of the room. I won't be here when you get back. Chapter 4. When my father was a boy, he traveled far to foster with a fierce warrior tribe across the narrow Irish Sea in the west. That was where he'd met my mother, herself no older than I was when I first met Mal. Years later, when Veriko was a man grown, he'd returned to woo her. She'd waited, knowing he would. I wasn't about to wait around for Malgun to return for me. Not in Derovenum. I couldn't possibly stay the night somewhere Aiden or my father could find me. Instead, I picked up my sword in its doeskin scabbard and stuffed it inside the bedroll I slung over my shoulder. There was one place I could spend the night, the one place Mal alone knew to look for me, whenever his foolish pride and rage left him. He should have said something, I thought bitterly. You didn't? The thought stopped me in my tracks. No, I didn't. I hadn't. When the moment came for me to stand up to my father, I just stood there, dumbly. Target practice. Well, no more. Now I would be a moving target. I threw on my cloak and slung the strap of the bedroll across my torso, with one last glance over my shoulder at my house, a place I suspected I might never see again. I pushed through the doorway and out into the night. I could hear the distant sounds of the revelers gathered in my father's great hall, still celebrating my vile betrothal. But beyond that, the bustling town of Derovenum was a place of shadows and fog. The rain had abated, and a silvery mist began collecting in the ditches. The gates of the town would be shut and locked, the walls guarded for the night, but that didn't matter to me. I slipped between the chieftain's roundhouses, past the smithy and the stables, to the place where I knew the earthworks were piled up close enough to the top of the town wall that I could climb over. I'd taken that route so many times with Mal that I could probably have followed it blindfolded. Mal. I tugged the hood of my cloak around my face. I would go to the Forgotten Vale, and I would wait there to see if Mal would follow, a day, two at the most, and then I would leave. He'll come. He has to. And then we would run, go west, travel through the mountains of Cymru, where the Dubuni tribe lived, and on through the territory of the mysterious Silures. I would sail across the Irish Sea to the land of my mother, a place where it's said that if the land ever felt the tread of legion sandals, the very earth itself would rise up like a wakening green giant and shrug them off like fleas. I can make a life for myself there, I thought as I ran. We can. My mother's kin would welcome me as a warrior, and Mal and I could fight side by side the way we were supposed to. That thought kindled the first tiny spark of hope since Veriko had stood in his hall and pronounced my doom. She's not yours. Damn your eyes. I froze. The damp air distorted the cry, turning it ghostly. But it was Mal's voice, followed by a grunt of pain and the muted clashing of blades. My heart hammered in my chest as I eased around the corner of a goat shed, peering in the direction of where the noise came from. The fog had grown thick, and I saw ghost dancers whirling in the heart of that silver pole. Mal and Aiden. Their shadowy forms grasped and grappled with each other, pulling apart and lurching together. The fog suddenly cleared enough for me to see Mal's face as he charged toward Aiden, the circling blurs of his two swords clearing the air before him. The blades rang as they met with Aiden's, locking up in the space between the two brothers as they tried to overpower each other. Suddenly, Aiden reared back and headbutted his brother sharply. Mal reeled away in pain, blood running down his face. The fog swirled, hiding them from my sight again. When it parted once more, I saw Mal, blades held high above his head, charging at Aiden. My heart hammered, and I heard myself whisper, "Mal." There was no earthly way he could have heard me. They were too far. It was only a whisper. And yet his swords, slashing downward to block his brother's attack, faltered. For just an instant. It was enough. Aiden was right there, charging forward, his blade thrusting for Mal's heart. "No!" My scream echoed silently inside my own head, but Mal's shocked cry alerted Derovenham's wall sentries. I heard a shout and the sound of running feet. I couldn't breathe, couldn't move. I clung to the wall of the goat shed as Mal's eyes locked with mine. He opened his mouth, and a dark gout of blood bubbled up and spilled down his chin. Aiden wrenched the dagger out of his brother's flesh, and Mal collapsed. He fell on his face in the mud, horribly still. Aiden's teeth were bared in a grimace, and he looked half mad.
"Brother," he croaked. "Malgorn."
Then he turned, searching to see what it was that had fatally distracted his brother. His eyes found my face in the darkness.
"Fallon."
The shouts of the sentries were closer now. Aiden glanced wildly over his shoulder and then back at me. For a moment, he hesitated. Then he bolted into the fog, running in the direction of Derovenham's wall. In an instant, he disappeared, swallowed whole by the night. The world around me turned red. If Aiden managed to escape Derovenham that night, he would vanish into the forest and run all the way back to his own halls, deep in the heart of the Trinovante lands, where he would be safe. A murderer, but safe. I angrily wiped the tears from my eyes as I began to run, heading in the direction Aiden had gone. That wasn't going to happen, not while I drew breath. When I reached the town wall, I scrambled up the mud-slick earthworks and tumbled gracelessly down the other side. Crouching, I peered at the ground. Aiden had left a clear trail of footprints in the muddy earth. As I stood, a thick drift of clouds swept over the full moon like snuffing out a flame. It didn't matter. I knew which way to go. The forest in front of me was hung with shadows, but I plunged into the trees, following the path of freshly broken branches that marked Aiden's way. He was headed toward the cart path that would lead him to the main road. He was running like a coward, a murderer. The sword I'd stuffed inside my bedroll rattled in its sheath as I ran, the sound keeping time with a single thought that repeated over and over in my head. Mal's dead. Mal's dead. Mal's dead. I stumbled blindly on, deep into the forest with one singular purpose. Vengeance. It was only after I had run far longer than it should have taken to pick up the cart path that I realized I was lost. I stopped and listened. Over the plashing of rainwater dripping from the forest leaves and the rasp of my own breathing, I could hear another sound. The sound of rushing water. No, I was near the river. I had gone in the exact opposite direction from where I'd meant to go. I cursed loudly, then clamped my hand over my mouth. Aiden could be somewhere nearby. I'd be a fool to alert him to my presence. The only way I wanted him to know I was there was when he looked down to see my sword in his guts. Cautiously, I pushed through a screen of saplings and found myself at the broad bank of the River Dur. A break in the cloud spilled down moongleam, and I looked down to see my reflection staring back at me from the dark water, green eyes glowing like the eyes of the cats we kept to kill rats. And I will kill a rat this night, I thought. I wrapped my heart in fury to keep the despair at bay as I knelt on the sodden grass of the riverbank to retrieve my sword from my bedroll. Before I could reach it, the moon disappeared behind the clouds again. As the river turned back to blackness, I caught the glimpse of a shadow looming up behind me in the reflection. I spun around, thinking Aiden had found me first. My hand went instead for my dagger, only to remember I'd left it lying in the embers of my home fire. It wasn't Aiden. A broad-shouldered man swung his fist like a mallet at my head. I fell, consumed by a dark red tide. When I awoke, I knew from the motion of the wet planks beneath me that I was on a boat, gliding silently down what I guessed was the Dur. Out of the cauldron and straight into the flames, I thought, as a cold dread pierced the nausea that already knotted my guts. This was the second time I'd been hit on the head in less than a day. I groaned and opened my eyes. The man from the riverbank was sitting on a bench in the middle of the little skiff, staring at me. Seeing that I was awake, he crouched down in front of me and grabbed my chin, forcing me to look up into his face. His eyes were two different colors, one watery blue, the other muddy brown. I opened my mouth in anger, but he put a finger, rough and calloused, to my lips. "Shush," he grinned, an ugly twisting of his mouth behind a matted beard. "Cry out, and that'll be the last sound you make. You understand?" His other hand pressed a knife blade up under my left ear. The scream building in my throat died instantly. I couldn't escape if I was dead.
"There's a good little can't eye, bitch."
His mismatched gaze roamed over me.
"She's not too ugly,"
he called quietly over his shoulder to the skiff's other occupant, a dark-haired man who pulled easily at the oars. Then he turned back to me and rolled the dagger blade over my cheek.
"If you behave, I won't have to ruin your face. You might even fetch a decent price."
A slave trader, I thought, numb with disbelief. The lowest kind of creature. Cunning peddlers always looking to capture and barter the lives of anyone unfortunate enough to cross their path unawares. My tribe came by most of our bond slaves through war and raids. Traders were reviled as parasites, a blight that had accompanied Rome to our shores. This one wore no talk, no armoring, no ornamentation of any kind to mark him as a free man or anything other than low-born. Of course, I realized, neither did I in that moment. I wore none of the embellishments that would have marked me as the daughter of a king. I had disavowed that status. My arms and neck were bare. No gold dangled from my ears. My boots and tunic were muddied and torn from my mad dash through the forest. They probably thought I was just a lowly thrall, easy picking. They were wrong, and I'd show them that as soon as I could get my sword.
"Were you running from someone, little slave?"
asked the man at the oars. He spoke Latin, like all the traders did, so I could understand him well enough, but his voice had a rolling lilt that I couldn't place. I ground my teeth together and said nothing. They laughed quietly at my silence. Over his shoulder, I could just make out the shape of a galley riding low in the water.
"No matter," he said, guiding the skiff toward the ship. "Whoever it is, you'll be far enough away from them once we get to Rome."
Rome. The word stunned me like another blow to the head. Over the sound of the waves lapping the sides of the skiff, I could hear muffled voices drifting down from the galley deck. Male, gruff, hissing hard-edged words into the night, and a smaller, forlorn noise. Weeping. A girl, maybe a young boy. Silenced with the sharp ring of a slap. It seemed I wasn't the only prey the slavers had hunted that night.
but I was probably the only one foolish enough to have run right into their arms. The skiff bumped against the side of the ship that loomed above us like a sea beast from a child's bedtime tale. Someone threw down a rope ladder, and Odd Eyes motioned me toward it with his knife. The boat rocked as I clumsily rose to my feet, almost pitching me into the black water. For an instant, I thought I might just do that, fling myself overboard and swim for all I was worth. Almost as if he heard my thoughts, Odd Eyes grabbed me by the hair and forced my head up, pointing with his knife. Standing at the railing, I saw a stocky form holding a bow, an arrow already knocked, and the bowstring half pulled.
"You even think of taking a bath and my mate there will put a hole in you before you hit the water," he hissed in my ear.
I had no choice but to climb the ladder, Odd Eyes and the dark-haired man following close behind. I'd never been on a sea-going vessel before, and my knees buckled as the deck of the ship tilted beneath my feet. I took a deep breath and tried to imagine that the rolling motion was the swaying of my racing chariot. This was just another challenge, I told myself, just another adversary to beat. I looked around for any possible escape, but Odd Eyes was right there, shoving me roughly toward a hatch in the middle of the deck that yawned like a gaping black maw. I heard the scrape of iron on wood as the anchor was dragged slowly on board, and I felt the ship lurching forward in the river current. As the forested riverbank slid away behind us, I bolted toward the ship railing. I made it 3 or 4 steps before Odd Eyes grabbed me and dealt a lazy backhand to my jaw that sent me reeling.
"Take her below,"
Odd Eyes growled, pushing me toward a heavily muscled man.
"She's got an urge to run. Convince her otherwise."
Chapter 5. Earlier that night, I had knelt on the floor of my house and slid the slender silver torque from around my neck. The torque had been a symbol of my status within the Kantii tribe, the daughter of a king. I had cast it onto the flames of the brazier and thought I'd never feel the cool, heavy caress of metal around my throat again. I was wrong. This new ring of metal was colder, heavier, and it marked me in just the same way, only now my status was slave. The collar was made of coarsely wrought iron, dull and chafing, hammered on with a bolt and tethered to a stout post in the hold by a chain through a ring. It was loose enough that it sat on my collarbones, but I still felt like I was choking. My people were fiercely protective of our freedom. To be a free man or free woman was to have status in the tribe, respect. I crouched in the darkness of the hold, the mingled stench of fish rot, mildew, sweat, and fear clogging my nostrils. My boots were soaked through with river water, and my feet had gone numb because of it. I slid the boots off and put them aside, rubbing my cramped toes between my palms. By the light of a single, swinging lantern that guttered and smoked, I could make out a handful of others chained, like I was, to posts. Men and women, most of them young, or at least not old, all of them able-bodied. The dark-haired man was clearly a discerning trader, and a thief. The people in the hold of that ship, myself included, hadn't been bartered for or bought in Derovenum. We'd just been taken, like cattle in a raid. But by the time the sun rose and any of their masters noticed they were missing, the slave galley would be safely down the river and sailing out to sea, on its way to make the channel crossing to Gaul, and taking me along with it. I stared at the swinging lantern and thought of the ones hanging in my house. Just like one of Sorsha's lamps, I was about to travel across the world to a place where I would be sold for a handful of coins. Something brushed against my ankle, and I jumped, shuddering, as the eyes of a rat flashed up at me, red and gleaming in the dimness. I tucked my cloak tighter around my legs and feet. Time passed with the rocking of the ship and the stink of rank seawater sloshing. I heard the hard snap of canvas sails in a freshening wind, and a leaden weight of despair made my heart sink. I knew we must have reached the mouth of the river where it emptied into the sea. I thought of Malgun, dead in the fog. I'm never going to see him again, I thought, and the realization hit me like a killing blow. I'd only just begun to see Mal as something more than a brother or friend, and suddenly he was gone. Gone from me forever. And not just him. My father, my tribe. They were all as good as dead to me. I squeezed my eyes shut, but everyone and everything I was leaving behind were there, floating like ghosts in my mind. I didn't know what else to do, so I whispered a prayer to the Morrigan, the triple goddess of blood and battles. Maybe not the most appropriate deity under the circumstances, but the one to whom I most often prayed. My throat was parched and my voice, when I tried to say the first of the three names of the raven goddess, came out as a crow's rasp. Maha. I licked my lips and tried again. Maha. Red Niman. Bav Kaha. Hear me. Wind, carry my words. Shadows and darkness, see my plight. Let the Morrigan hear my plea. Give me strength to vanquish my enemies and wreak my vengeance. I whispered the prayer over and over again until finally I slipped into a deep, exhausted sleep. Thin beams of sunlight crept through the cracks between the deck planks and pierced the gloom. I blinked blearily in confusion for a moment before I was able to figure out where I was and what had woken me. Odd Eyes crouched on his haunches in front of me, grinning. His mismatched gaze raked my face and limbs.
Not too ugly,
he said again, as he had on the skiff. But he spoke not in Latin this time, but in the language of my own people. His accent told me he was Catu Veloni, and the sound of it turned my fear to anger. The slaver was a Celt, but from a tribe notorious for their sly, thieving ways. I decided once I escaped, and I would escape. I would cut his throat in vengeance for this affront to the Cantii and the house of my father. He must have seen the defiance flare in my eyes.
Prickly Cantii bitch! Think you're better than me?
I know I am, I said.
Huh, he barked. I'm not the one with the collar around my neck.
No, I said. I suspect your thieving kind wouldn't know the feel of metal around your neck. He grabbed a handful of my hair and forced my head back, thrusting his face so close that I could feel his hot, sour breath in my ear.
Don't insult my honor, little thrall, he growled. You stink of the swamps and the muck of that bloody island, same as I once did.
At least I don't stink of Rome, I said through gritted teeth. The blow came almost before the hated word had left my tongue, a short, sharp jab to my stomach. Gasping for breath, I couldn't cry out as I felt Odd Eyes grasp at me, his thick fingers fumbling at the lacing of my tunic. I kicked and swore at him, but I was chained, and he was much stronger. I didn't know if I could fight him off. I heard the sound of my tunic ripping, and then he was gone. I fell forward into empty air, and my eyes flew open. Dust motes danced crazily in the slivers of sunlight through the deck planks, swirling around a silhouetted figure. It was the dark-haired slave master from the skiff. He stood above Odd Eyes, who was suddenly flat on his back, and he held a long knife in one fist. There was a moment of stillness that stretched out between the two men, broken only by the hitching sounds in my throat as I tried to catch my breath.
Get up, Havgar, the slave master said calmly. I said, get up.
Odd Eyes lurched to his feet.
Wasn't doing anything with a little slave that hasn't been done 100 times, I'd wager. Enough, Havgar.
The slave master turned to me and said,
did he hurt you, girl?
I shook my head, tugging my tunic down where it was ruched halfway up my thigh.
Good,
he sighed, and resheathed the dagger at his belt.
Means I don't have to hurt him.
He turned back to Odd Eyes, Havga, and said,
Bring her up on deck, unscathed.
He pushed past Havga and stalked toward the ladder.
Now, Havga.
I scrambled in the semi-darkness for my boots, but they were gone, stolen while I slept. None of the other slaves would look at me as Havga muttered darkly, unfastening the chain attached to my collar and yanking me roughly to my feet. Up on deck and blinking in the watery sunlight, I could see off in the distance the white chalk cliffs, sacred to the goddess, guardians of the Isle of the Mighty, soaring above the breaking surf. I had never seen the shores of my home from so far out on the sea before. The sight of the cliffs diminishing as the sails billowed in the wind and the ship gathered speed made me want to weep. Havga prodded me forward across the deck toward the canvas tent near the stern. He reached out in front of me and slapped aside the flap. I squared my shoulders and cast a black glare at him before I ducked my head and stepped into the interior. The slave master sat in a low backless chair in the middle of the tent, watching me with a frown. He was younger than I'd thought, perhaps only in his mid to late 20s, but his full, neatly trimmed beard and rich garments and the cool look in his eyes made him seem older. He carried himself with an air of authority and must have been utterly ruthless to have achieved an elevated station among his gang of brutes at such a young age. He had my sheepskin travel roll resting across his knees, and I swallowed against the knot of fear in my throat as he dismissed Havga with a cursory wave. The silence that followed stretched out between us as he regarded me wordlessly. Eventually, he seemed to come to some kind of decision about me. His lip twitched, and he looked down at his loosely clasped hands.
They call me Charon, he said finally. I'm from Macedonia. I don't expect you would know, or care where that is.
I shrugged. He was right. I didn't know where Macedonia was, but it sounded very far away.
And who are you? He asked.
I hesitated, surprised. Were slave traders always so curious about their property? Charon's eyes flicked back up to my face.
What's your name?
Perhaps, I thought, if I told him who I really was, he would ransom me back to my father. But the stirring of hope in my heart was extinguished with my next thought. Why would he believe you? There was absolutely nothing I could do to prove my identity short of demanding they turn the ship around and go knocking at the doorpost of my father's great hall to ask if he'd been missing any wayward daughters of late. And if, say, by the capricious will of the goddess, that actually happened? In running away, I had no doubt humiliated Veriko, and I was certain Aiden's snake tongue had already poured poison lies into his ears. My father would probably just give me back to Aiden and be done with it. He'd made it plain in his feast hall last night that he didn't really care what happened to me. I watched Charon warily as he reached for my sleeping roll and unfurled it with a sharp tug. My few possessions spilled out across the deck between us, and my sword dropped to the planking with a dull clank. I stared at its decorated bronze and doe-skin sheath, a twist of longing tightening in my chest.
Where did you get that?
Charon waved a hand at the blade.
Did you steal it?
I didn't steal it, I glared at him. I'm not a thief, like you. He raised an eyebrow at me.
And what is it I've stolen? Exactly? He asked.
Me. I jerked my chin in the direction of the ship's hold, where the other slaves were chained. Them. We don't belong to you.
And who do you belong to, little slave?
His dark eyes glinted. Again, I closed my mouth, still unsure of whether or not to reveal my identity. The sword rested inches from my toes, and my fingers itched to reach for the weapon. but I knew that would only get me killed. Charon stood and crossed the space between us, reaching for the blade himself. He pulled it free of the scabbard, and his thumb swept back and forth over the markings engraved on the blade just below the hilt. The beauty of its clean, lethal lines still took my breath away. That sword, and the destiny it represented, meant more to me than anything. The design was a knotted triple raven, the mark of the Morrigan. And I remembered with stark clarity the day Sorcia had taken me to the blacksmith. I had perched on a high stool in the firelit forge and witnessed, for the first time, the birthing of a blade. Sorcia had left the sword behind, hanging on the wall of our house when she had ridden into battle. When she didn't return, I had claimed it for my own, promising to honor her legacy as a warrior.
"Whose sword is this?"
Charon asked again. I felt suddenly as if my fate hung, suspended, on the cusp of tipping one way or another. The shadow of a seabird flew across the tent wall, or maybe it was one of the Morrigan's ravens. "It's mine," I said in a dry whisper.
"Who gave it to you?"
I bit my lip and stayed silent.
"Tell me,"
he said. And then, after a long pause,
"Please."
There was something about the way he said it that compelled me to speak the truth. Maybe it was just the unexpected please, but it seemed as though it went deeper than mere curiosity. "It was my sister's," I said.
Charon's eyes narrowed. "Your sister must be a fine warrior to handle a blade like this."
"She's dead." The word sounded flat and ugly in my ears. "When I was young, she left one day to fight the Romans. She never came home. Now, the sword is mine." I watched Charon's jaw work as he chewed the inside of his cheek, lost in thought. Then he blinked rapidly and turned away, and it was as if a veil had fallen behind his eyes, his expression unreadable once more.
"It's a fine blade," he said, hefting the slender weapon and testing its balance. "I wonder that she didn't take it with her into the field."
"My sister could kill a man with a dull fish knife," I said fiercely. "She was the weapon. The blade she used was of no consequence." It was true. Sorcia had owned many swords, many daggers, all of them marked with the same triple raven knot. And yet this one was special. She'd said as much on the day we'd gone to the forge. It was a twin to the sword she carried. But this sword would be mine one day, she told me. And when that happened, when the day came that I was old enough and worthy enough, and the sword passed into my hands, I was to guard it with my life. Because, Sorcia told me, it would mean my life. I hadn't known exactly what she'd meant, but my sister had often said things like that. Sorcia, when she was alive, had made it a custom to spend long hours in close, secret conversation with Olan, my father's chief druid. The Druiden were the sages and mystics of our tribe. They dealt in portents and prophecies, and I'd often wondered if Sorcia had known something in the days before she left to fight Caesar's men, something she wouldn't tell me. I wondered if that was why she'd left the blade behind, as a legacy for her little sister. Maybe Sorcia had known she was going to die and leave me to grow up without her. Even if she had, she still would have gone, I thought. Just like I would have. That is the warrior's way.
"Such ferocity you have," Charon said. "Following in your sister's footsteps, perhaps?"
I felt a shiver across my shoulders at his words, like the brush of dark wings on my skin. Following in Sorcia's footsteps was exactly what the Druiden had foreseen as my destiny. The Morrigan, it seemed, had willed it otherwise. I could only hope that the path she'd set my feet upon would lead me to a fate as honorable as my sister's.
"Can you fight?" he asked. I can fight, I said, lifting my chin.
Better than you. Better than all of your men.
Charon raised an eyebrow at me.
Really?
Give me back my sword and find out for yourself.
No.
He laughed and slid the blade back into its sheath.
No, I believe you. And so I'll keep this out of your reach.
For now. He stepped out through the tent flap, and I heard him speak to Havgar.
Take her back down to the hold, he said. Let the rest of the men know that she is not to be mistreated.
You keeping her for yourself?
Havgar leered.
I froze. It was something I hadn't considered.
Just do it, Charon said. Tell them I'll chop off the hand of the first man who touches her and feed it to the fishes.
I silently thanked the Morrigan as I descended back down into the darkness of the slave ship's hold, grateful for the smallest of mercies. Still, I knew that the journey ahead of me would be long and terrible, and Charon's continued kindness was the very last thing I could count on. Chapter 6. Scalp to soul, I was one long mile of misery. I had lost track of how many days it had been since a Lunasa feast in my father's great hall. How many nights would it have been since they'd laid Malgun's body on the funeral pyre? If I closed my eyes, I could imagine it. His swords crossed on his chest, the flames climbing upwards to lick at his face, hungrily consuming him. Did Aiden run all the way home? I wondered. Or did he skulk back to watch from a distance as the smoke and sparks rose into the sky to carry his brother's spirit to the other world? I swore to myself. Every day of that whole horrible journey, I swore that I would find a way to return and make him pay for Mal's death. They would have to remove my chains at some point, either to sell me or to put me to work after I'd been sold. And when they did, I would run, hide, make my way home and have my revenge. I swore it on my soul. Mine and Malgun's. I owed him that. But as the weeks wore on, my oaths began to sound hollow in my ears. As it did every day on that infinite stretch since we'd landed on the northern shore of Gaul and began our trek overland, the caravan rumbled to a stop around midday as the sun reached its apex. The air around the cage carts would grow hot, rank with the stench of unwashed bodies and sickness and fear, and full of dust and flies beneath a glaring sun. My once pale, freckled skin was burnt and tender. My eyes and nostrils were full of road grit, and my throat was parched and raw. I'd lost count of the towns and villages we'd passed through, where the townsfolk stared and the children dared each other to throw rocks at the cages. But that morning, instead of the usual midday break, our caravan joined up on the road with another wagon train coming from the east, bearing more slaves and trade goods. The two groups blended together, and I was moved into a larger cage cart. This one was populated entirely with girls, an even dozen of us altogether, around my age. The girls in the cart all wore slave collars the same as mine, with a single long chain running through the rings attached to their collars, linking them together, and then through more rings that were bolted to the cage bars. I was prodded up into the enclosure, and my collar attached to the end of that same chain. Strung together, I thought, like 12 broken beads on a tarnished necklace. We were also each chained to a partner, linked in pairs to the girl that sat opposite us by manacles around our ankles. I never had recovered my stolen boots, and without them for protection, the iron shackle chafed horribly, and the skin on my ankle and across the top of my left foot quickly became blistered and raw. Over the next 2.5 days, the agony grew so that I couldn't take it anymore. When Charon himself passed near my cage, I loudly asked why the leg chain was necessary.
Raiders,
he nodded at the encroaching hills, cloaked in heavy forests. It was the first time Charon had spoken directly to me since we'd been on board the ship.
When Caesar broke Arviragus' resistance and thrashed the Arverni tribe and their allies almost out of existence, he continued, the few survivors fled into these hills. They've nowhere to go, and no other way to live. This is lawless country now, and I'd be a fool to make it easy for a raiding party to come and steal my property now, wouldn't I?
You're already stolen property, I said.
Charon laughed. And how pathetic would you be if you were twice pilfered, little slave? You should be grateful I take such precautions. The raiders would not be so gentle.
He paused before moving on.
We'll be traveling through the night, he said. It will be dangerous, but less dangerous than making camp. Perhaps you'd be good enough to offer up a prayer to your fearsome raven goddess, that we don't draw any unwanted attention down upon us.
For a moment, I didn't understand how he would even know what goddess I prayed to. But then I remembered he still had my sword, etched with the Morrigan's triple raven knot. Charon had recognized it and remembered. The slave master grinned at me wryly. He unstoppered his leather water bag and sloshed a generous measure into the dust-dry cup that rested on the floor beside me. I was too thirsty to be astonished. I greedily sucked down the few mouthfuls of water, letting the cup fall to rest again on the wagon floor between my feet. My raw, raging thirst slaked for a moment. I leaned my head back against the cage bars and closed my eyes. After a long, silent moment, I could feel the other girls watching me with envy or dull curiosity, or outright animosity. I did my best to ignore them as darkness descended on the winding road and the shadows of the forest swallowed the caravan whole. Hours passed, and a full moon rose high overhead in a star-spattered sky. I groaned and rolled my head on my stiff neck. The girl on the far side of the cage, the one I was chained to by my left ankle, was staring at me with bleak hostility. She had been ever since Charon had poured the water in my cup. Beneath a high forehead, made even higher by the white blonde hair braided tightly back from her face in rows, her eyes were blue, but so pale in the moonlight that they almost seemed silver, and they were just as cold and hard. In the 3 days we'd been shackled together, I'd never heard her utter a sound. Until now. Her voice, when she spoke, was deep and strong. Her words harsh.
You think you're precious, little vixen?
The corner of her lips, as chapped and peeling as mine, lifted in a sneer. She spoke in Latin, probably learned from traders the same way I had. Only hers was thickly seasoned with her native barbaric accent. I had heard one of the slavers say that some of the other girls were of the Varini tribe, a warlike people from cold northern lands. She certainly fit the description herself.
Think you're special, she said.
Yeah.
Then she leaned forward and, heedless of wasting precious moisture, hawked and spat on the floor of the cart between my feet. The other captives were now awake and watching us with darting, anxious glances. I took a deep breath to cool the sudden burn of anger in my chest. Then I frowned, tilting my head as I regarded the other girl. Forgive me if I've misunderstood you, I said in the best trader-learned Latin I could muster. Your accent, after all, is terribly ugly. But did you just call me a dog? Her sneer hardened into a mocking smile.
Fox, she waved dismissively. Small, pointy, wild dog. Cowardly things. Very noisy. When they...
Her Latin failed her then, but the obscene gesture she made with her fingers more than conveyed her meaning. I felt my shoulders go tight, and one of the other girls snickered.
Scavengers, the Varini girl shrugged.
But yeah, That's all you seem to me. Not so very special.
But I had been special, I thought. Once I had been special to a boy with steel grey eyes who had loved me, and I had thrown all of it away. My hands clenched into fists at my sides. She noticed and raised an eyebrow.
Not so very tough.
As we glared at each other across the cramped space, the other occupants of the cage wagon shifted away from the two of us, rattling the chains. The Verini girl shrugged again and nudged my empty water cup with the toe of her sandal.
Or maybe he doesn't think you're special. Maybe he just thinks you're in heat, little fox.
My vision blurred, and I heard myself snarl in rage as I launched myself across the cage. I was brought up short and sharp by the iron ring around my neck, which, of course, was still attached to the chain that ran through the rings on all the other girls' collars. Still, the force of my lunge was such that a girl on the other end of the cage cart was yanked hard over into the girl beside her, cheek mashing up against the other girl's shoulder, who then fell against the girl on her other side. They squealed in startled outrage, and the other girls began to scream and shout too as the Verini girl threw herself out of my range, dragging along the girls on her side of the cage. A chaotic tangle of limbs and chains writhed and thrashed as the endless days of fear and frustration boiled over into violence. The Verini was tall and lanky, and when she lashed out at me with one long leg, the leather sole of her sandals slapped painfully against my thigh. I grunted in pain and half rolled over. The girl next to me flailed at me with balled fists, but didn't really know how to fight. I knew how to fight. In the confined space hemmed in by bars, it was easy enough to land blows, but it was just as easy to have them land on me. I took two glancing hits from the Verini girl's long-reaching fists before I felt my own connect solidly with her ribs. She yelped and twisted to avoid a follow-up punch, dragging the chain-linked girls in her wake. The cage cart tilted perilously as it raced along the dirt track. The driver, sitting in front of the cage on a wooden seat, swore loudly as our frenzied thrashing rocked the cart, and he banged on the bars of the cage with the stout oak club he carried. He shouted at us to settle down, or he would stop the wagon and give us all a beating. I barely noticed. I was too busy reeling from a punch to the face. Pain exploded from my left cheek, and a red mist ascended in front of my eyes. After all the days and nights of dull despair and helplessness, the fierce urge to fight something, anything, anyone, welled in my chest. I howled in fury and swung my clenched fist in a double blow that caught the Verini on the temple and sent her reeling.
You're both mad!
A girl with long black curls shouted above the chaos.
Stop! You'll get us all killed!
In the darkness, the skinny wheels of the wagon bearing our prison cage weaved crazily in the rutted tracks of the road. The driver, had he been thinking, could have immediately dealt with us at a standstill. But Charon had warned his men not to stop, and there was no wagon behind us to notice the commotion. Ours was the last vehicle in the caravan that night, except for a heavy, guarded ox-pulled provisions wagon that was even slower. Slow enough to have fallen far behind and out of sight. Which meant that there was nothing to stop me from trying to shove the Verini girl's ugly insinuations back down her throat. I only had to reach her first. I wedged my left hand beneath the metal ring that circled my neck so I wouldn't choke, and then I hauled on the slave chain with all my strength. I managed to gather just enough slack to connect to the side of the Verini girl's head with the full force of my right fist. Her head snapped back. She fell heavily against her side of the cage with enough force to send the whole cart careening sideways. The slave driver shouted in alarm as the wagon rocked wildly on the uneven road. As the cage suddenly tipped over and began rolling down a steep embankment, girls screamed and grappled for anything to hold on to. My shoulder hit the roof of the cage with enough force to send blinding pain shooting through my whole body, and the girl, chained on my right, landed on top of me, driving the wind from my lungs. When the cage came to a halt at the bottom of a ditch, There was a moment of utter stillness, broken only by the spinning creak of the two wheels churning away uselessly above our heads. The other girls began to groan and whimper, pushing themselves to their hands and knees, tangled in their chains and each other's limbs. The cage had split apart like a rotten fruit, and I staggered to my feet and stepped free of the broken bars. The two cart horses, their shattered yokes hanging from their necks, scrambled to their feet and bolted back up the embankment. I sucked in my breath at the sight of the slave driver, who'd been pinned beneath one of the animals. His head was bent at an unnatural angle, and his mouth was frozen open in a silent cry of shock. A slick of dark blood painted the side of his face, and his eyes were empty and staring. I stumbled back a step, and the chain that had held me, tethered to the other girls by the ring around my neck, slid free and fell to the ground in pieces. Broken links chiming tuneless music as they hit the stony ground beneath my feet. I'm free, I thought as elation surged through me. No, not exactly. I cursed as I saw that the shackle that circled my left ankle was woefully intact. I was still bound by the short length of stout iron links to the Verini girl, who was clambering unsteadily to her feet. She seemed to realize at the very same moment that I did the irony of our situation. In the trees high above our heads, I heard the throaty chuckle of a raven and imagined it was the wry laughter of the Morrigan, amused at my predicament. My goddess was capricious in her affections. I'd always known that, but I was beginning to think that when she'd called me daughter, it was only to mock my efforts to live up to that honor. I glanced around at the faces of the other girls, pale moons in the darkness, and said, "This is our chance." Not one of them moved. The Verini girl said nothing, but I saw the muscles on her jaw clench. When I locked eyes with her, she gave me a curt nod. So be it. Together we stepped carefully away from the twisted mess of bars and planks. I hesitated briefly when the dark-haired girl, the one who had shouted for us to stop fighting, put a hand on my arm.
"This isn't a chance. This is madness," she said in a low, frantic voice. "Listen to me. I was born into my lot. I've been a slave my whole life, with never the chance to be anything but. And I'll still gladly take that fate over running wild through this countryside, waiting to be caught and killed by lawless men. Killed, if you're lucky. You heard what Charon said." I looked over her shoulder, out at the deep, dark, utterly still forest. "I heard him," I said. "I don't believe him. These hills are deserted. There is nothing here but the spirits of the Averni murdered by Caesar's legions." I said it in a voice loud enough to almost make myself believe it. "Stay here if that's what you want." I lifted her hand from my shoulder. "But I'll take my chances with dead men, lawless or not."
"Wait."
She bent down and yanked off her worn leather slippers and held them out. When I hesitated, she thrust them at me.
"Take them," she urged, nodding at my own bare feet. "Take the shoes and my prayers to the goddess for you. You'll need them both."
The girl's gaze was strangely compassionate. She knew just by looking at me that I wasn't like her. I wasn't a slave. I never had been. I'd only ever been a princess and a warrior. The irony, I realized, was that she was stronger than me because of it. This was a girl who would choose to stay chained if it meant that her odds of survival were even so much as a hair's breadth better. And there was strength in that choice. The sheer, bloody-minded will to survive, no matter how dreadful the circumstance. Maybe honor wasn't always something won by a blade, I thought. And maybe it couldn't be so easily stripped away, even in servitude. I ducked my head and snatched the shoes from the girl's fingers, shame heating my cheeks.
"Thank you,"
I murmured as I stuffed my feet into them. The soles of the leather slippers were almost worn through in places, but they fit snugly. As I straightened up from tying the lacings, My Varini shacklemate reached down and grasped a fistful of the iron links that tethered us together.
If you slow me down, she growled, I'll heck your foot off with a sharp stone.
I won't slow you down, I said, so long as you keep your big, flat feet out of my way.
Pale blue eyes blinked at me for a moment. Then the Varini grinned, an expression utterly devoid of mirth, and said,
Run!
Chapter 7. It was awkward at first. The Varini girl's legs were longer than mine, but once we settled into a rhythm, we made surprisingly good speed through the forest, navigating an increasingly steep incline by moonlight. But then my foot hit something hard and angular, and I stumbled and fell forward onto my hands and knees. The tall blonde stumbled to a stop, cursing in her own tongue before spinning on her heel to tower over me, one fist clenched.
Clumsy idiot,
she snarled, her voice a raw scrape of sound in the darkness.
I told you, if you slowed me down, I'd
hack my foot off, I snapped. I remember. I looked down at the thing that had tripped me and tugged on it. With one good heave, I stood to face the Varini, lifting a short, broad-bladed sword streaked with dirt. I smiled as she froze, staring at the weapon in my hand.